Nelson.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners.
Welcome to the 15th edition of the Center Steer Podcast. I'm your host, John Costas, located in wonderful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Although the day is not as wonderful as it was last time, today it is a little overcast. It is a summer solstice, though. It is the longest daylight of the year. Not the longest day, the longest daylight. I always get annoyed. Today we have two panelists with us, and I'm declaring Steve a panelist now, even though he's probably technically a guest. Harold is not here yet. He is on his way. We've had some technical difficulties, and we've kind of gotten through those, I hope. And yet again, technical difficulties, and Harold is a little behind. But via Skype, we have Morgan.
I'm Morgan from Vermont, and we've got a little bit nicer weather today. And a little cool and breezy, so that's kind of nice. Glad to have the longest day, what with our technical difficulties and everything.
Do you have any special plans for the longest day? Light?
Not particularly.
You're recording the podcast. You're spending all your day trying to record the podcast.
All your daylight.
And over in nighttime, is it nighttime, Steve?
Well, early evening.
Early-ish.
Yeah. Half past six.
And you're in higher latitude, so you also get more daylight.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. Little interesting fact and I've always found this interesting. Pittsburgh is on the same latitude. That's the ones that run east-west, right? It's on the same latitude as, I think, Barcelona, Spain.
Oh, really? Yes. Yeah, I'm quite a bit higher than.
Yes, you are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
When I spent 6 months in the UK back in 1991, and I'm like, it's dark. It was just like January, February, and we get dark at what, 2:30, 3 o'clock? Wow! And then that's when I realized that in the summertime, of course, it doesn't get dark till 10 or 11, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
It explains why they have all these murder mysteries and all these things happen, and it's like, come on, people, shouldn't you be in bed? So that's today's show. Hopefully Harold will join us. We have Morgan is joining us from Vermont, and Steve is joining us from the United Kingdom. He is going to shortly talk about his journey that he took to the Arctic Circle. We'll get an update from him on that. First up is the news, and we always like to start with sales. Why not? I like to know what's happening with the brand and where it's going. Overall, for May of 2014, Jag Land Rover JLR was up 17%. Specifically, Land Rover was up 27% over May of 2013. They sold an additional 1,000 vehicles by volume. And unfortunately, Jaguar was down 10%. They sold, oddly enough, only 100 less vehicles. So I guess their volume is considerably less. So things are looking good for Land Rover as far as selling cars. And that translates into they have added or will add 250 new jobs and £200 million to the British economy at their Halewood plant, and they are that's where the Discovery Sport is going to be produced, and they are working at it there at the Halewood plant, and there's a lot of discussion in this article about increase in jobs, increase in investment. They're adding £400 million investment to the auto industry in the UK, and the Land Rover Discovery Sport will go on sale, I think, in 15, and that's where that vehicle is going to be produced, and they've added these jobs at that plant, and they're going to produce, I think, a number of other vehicles there. I'm trying to skim the article and talk at the same time. Does anybody have anything they want to add to that? Maybe Steve might.
Yeah, I was going to say, as you may be aware, that the UK over recent years have had real issues around manufacturing, and we've had more car plants closing than opening. So anything like this is great, and it's up in Liverpool, so it's around the Merseyside area, so I'm sure they're all going to be very happy up there. I think it's a brilliant bit of news, really, to be honest. I'd only heard about it, a few minutes ago, so I think that's great news.
Excellent. Good deal.
And I having seen the company, you know, the purchase by various other companies over the years, and now to Tata, an Indian company, it's nice to see that they really are still investing in England.
Yeah, that is true, actually. Yeah, there's always, I mean, I think there was always a fear that Tata would just take it away. But yeah, the fact it's staying here is really great.
That is good news, and they're talking about the workforce growing to 4,750 folks. I think the way the article reads it, I think it's just at that point.
Yeah.
And they say since 2010, Jag has invested £500 million in the Halewood plant, which produced more than 340,000 cars last year. And apparently not many of them come to the United States, though. Sorry, a little jab there. Yeah, I know. Speaking of Tata, they are going to reuse the Land Rover Freelander platform, the Freelander 2, and they're going to use that as the platform for basis of a flagship SUV, apparently available in India. And I guess it's supposed to kind of looks like compete with the Toyota Fortuner. I thought that said Front Runner when I first read it, but it's actually Fortuner. I don't know if that's a typo or if that's actually the name of the vehicle. But at least the Freelander will live on, apparently, in some fashion, even if it's just its chassis in another vehicle.
And a quick Googling does show that the Fortuner is a Toyota vehicle for India.
Any idea what is that a I suspect that might be more of a, not the CRV size. What's that?
It looks to be sort of.
I know Honda's a CRV.
Right, right. It seems to be based on the Hilux, so it's more of like a a 4Runner.
Right. I think that's the. Yeah, I think we call the. Yeah, the Hilux here is the 4Runner, right?
It's the. I think it's the Tacoma line and the 4Runner line, sort of.
I don't think. Split
out to two.
See, I don't think the Tacoma is available outside of North America. I think that's only available here. That's my understanding. I could be wrong. But this is not a Toyota podcast. So that's bonus content.
That is definitely not. Exactly.
That's right. That's all bonus content right there for you. All right. So Tata is doing its thing, and it sounds like they're doing good stuff, at least in the UK. That's good news. Next bit of news has to do with special operations, and we turn it over to our special operations correspondent, Morgan.
I wish I had a lot more details. Make me sound like such a professional.
Good.
apparently, Jaguar Land Rover has changed their what was the original? I will come back to that. Basically, they have started a new special vehicle operations group, which will be doing the same thing that they used to do in terms of making like expedition spec Land Rover Defenders. But they will also be doing, expanding out into restoration of classic Land Rovers and providing, parts for classic Land Rovers. This will be out of, they're near Coventry. I believe that this is something that Jaguar has already done. For some time, especially restorations of their classic vehicles. So this is sort of an expansion out into the Land Rover side. Very interesting. Looks like some of the first of the Land Rover vehicles that they are doing will be shown off at the Goodwood Festival of Speed.
I think you're looking for, it was called the, I was reading it, it went away too. It was engineered to order, which is kind of a, yes. I don't know if that's the actual name or if that was just what they called it, but you know, like internally. But it doesn't. I think special vehicle operation sounds much better.
Agreed.
I have to say the article we're looking at, which is on Auto Week, starts off with Lockheed Martin has Skunk Works, Aston Martin has Q. Like, come on, Skunk Works is real. I get that, but you know, Q and Aston Martin. Come on, so that's good. Wonder if any of those will come to the United States or if that's all going to be outside of North America. A lot of that stuff is typically done everywhere but here.
Exactly. Certainly seems like, you know, it, in terms of the restorations, I'm sure someone can pay for a restoration there and then have it re-imported to the U.S. because it's over 25 years old. But, you know, in terms of their new Expedition Spec Defenders, doubtful.
Right. Although there are a number of restoration companies here in the U.S. So the East Coast Rovers, I think, does restoration.
Yep, they've actually gotten out of Classic Land Rovers. They only do Defenders this point.
Yep. I did not know that. And what's the there's one, Defenders Northwest. They seem like a restoration specialist for, again, for Defenders, but up in the northwest of the United States, in Washington. That's, I think, where they're from. So those are the two that at least come to mind that I know of.
Yep.
So apparently, if you're in North America, you have to go go to your own devices. Steve, in the UK, is this a big thing? Especially,
do you know what? It's something that isn't very big. I'm just looking at a different article from Auto Express, and they're saying that the one of the first models they're going to do is a super fast version of the Range Rover Sport. That's the first model they're going to do.
Isn't the Range Rover Sport already fast?
Well, it does actually say super fast. So exactly what that's going to be, I don't know.
Interesting, because that supercharged Sport, which granted is it's a Range Rover Sport supercharged, and that's something like 3.9 seconds to 60. I can't imagine that going any faster. Aren't they teasing also this week? They've been teasing about the new Range Rover Sport fast model on the Nürburgring, and I didn't want to talk about it yet because there's nothing to talk about, but at least for that. But they've been teasing that this week. I can only imagine, to me, 4 seconds 0 to 60 for an SUV. Do you really want to get much faster?
It'd be an interesting challenge across the field. That's for sure.
Well, I guess that would be the thing. Can you keep it, keep it almost like a hovercraft where, you're stable in the car and everything else, the undercarriage is bouncing around, which, that takes all the fun out of it then.
Yeah.
So does this mean Land Rover is going to start competing with Bowler, who basically does the custom?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, they already teamed up with them, last year? Maybe this is part of that, maybe it's part of that collaboration where they're getting some things from Bowler to that help bolster their stuff.
Certainly possible, yeah.
Don't leave it to the auto companies to not steal something from each other, because we know that's happened in the past, and we'll always do that. As I contend, that's what BMW did. They bought Land Rover so they could get the Range Rover information, and then they turned around and built the X5. And then like, oh, we don't need you anymore. Bye-bye.
Mm.
I do tend to think that occurred.
So related to the SVO news for Classic Land Rovers, there is some news for Series Land Rover enthusiasts. The disc brake conversion kits, originally manufactured by Tim Cooper, are going to be available through a new company. They were most recently produced by a company called Rome Off-Road, who closed in January. But there's a new company, Forbyn, Forbyn Brothers, who are starting to manufacture these. And unlike a lot of the other disc brake conversion kits for the Series Land Rovers, makers like Heisty and forgetting the other brand off the top of my head, these ones don't use off the shelf parts from more local brands like GM. They use actual Defender discs and calipers and all of that. So these are basically new swivel knuckles that are designed to mount Defender discs and calipers, rotors and calipers. And they are going to be selling a front disc conversion kit for $1,400. Now, that does not include
dollars the actual... Pounds?
Dollars. They're U.S.-based. So that doesn't include the Yikes. Rotors or calipers or pads, but it does include new swivel knuckles and basically all the fasteners you need and hoses. And you can also get a rear kit for, I think they're $500. So expensive. But as as you know, driving a Series Land Rover, the brakes are a little... They leave you wanting.
Why would you say that? I don't understand. I have no idea. You mean like it pull? Like I had forgotten how cars can pull when you hit the brakes, especially in an emergency kind of situation. Ooh. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So giving, you know, a series Land Rover is a heavy vehicle, giving it a little more stopping power. They also help certainly for off-roading, because they don't have problems like if you take, you know, drum brakes through a water crossing. You kind of have to wait for them to drain and dry out before they become effective again. Not a problem with disc brakes. Also, the Land Rover brakes are really, the shoes on them are set up to really only be advantageous if you're going up a hill. So if you are nose down in a situation, your brakes are not going to be as effective. So disc brakes can help greatly with that. That's why the fronts are the biggest conversion.
Well, even when disc brakes were first on the scene, they were always doing the front wheel of those. And you used to have, for a long time, you know, you had front disc and rear drum in most cars. And then as the price dropped and it made sense, they went, you know, four-wheel disc. So.
Exactly.
Makes some sense there.
Yep. And part of that was actually related to the ease of implementing an emergency brake or parking brake with disc brakes, right, which was not easy. Drums are easy, and you can make them manual without requiring hydraulics. But they've worked around some of those technical limitations.
So you'll send me a link, and we'll add it to our show notes?
Absolutely.
Good deal. Good deal. That is the news.
Harold's M-Word.
It was a cold night in early 1908 when Byron J. Carter set out for a drive through the streets of Detroit. Carter was the founder of a car maker named Carter Car, so when he happened upon another motorist who had stalled out, he was compelled to stop and offer assistance. Despite his expertise, Carter had difficulty getting the car restarted. Engines back then had to be cranked over by hand to get them started. If conditions weren't perfect, the engine would often backfire or kick back, which would frequently result in broken arms or dislocated shoulders. In this case, the car broke Carter's jaw when its engine kicked back. Complications from his injury resulted in Carter's death a few months later. Soon thereafter, Carter's car company was purchased by a fledgling automaker named General Motors. While this would seem like the end of the story for Carter, it's really just the beginning of a much bigger story. You see, the car that injured Carter was a Cadillac. Although it was a rival car maker, Cadillac was founded by Henry Leland, who was a personal friend of Carter's. Coincidentally, Cadillac had also been recently acquired by General Motors, and when Leland received the news of Carter's death, he was deeply affected. Leland got his start in the automobile industry as an engine maker, and like many of the pioneers in the engine business, he had a background in toolmaking and gunsmithing. He greatly advanced the concept of interchangeable parts, and his focus on precision and quality would quickly establish the Cadillac as one of the finest cars in the world. So to find out that his friend was fatally injured by a Cadillac was simply unacceptable. Leland made a vow that the Cadillac car will kill no more men if we can possibly help it. When Cadillac's engineers were unable to find a practical solution to the problem, Leland called on Charles Kettering. Kettering had graduated from The Ohio State University in 1904 with a degree in electrical engineering. He was immediately hired to head the research department at National Cash Register Company in Dayton, Ohio. Kettering revolutionized the cash register business when he invented the electric register, and a cash register that printed paper receipts. He also invented a credit approval system that was the precursor to today's credit cards. In 1907, Kettering was convinced by his NCR colleague, Edward Deeds, that there was a huge opportunity for profit in developing improvements for the automobile. Deeds referred to it as a river of gold running past us. Kettering and several fellow engineers at NCR spent their evenings and weekends working in Deeds' barn. They called themselves the Barn Gang, and Kettering was known as Boss Kett. Their first project was producing an electric spark ignition system that would be more powerful and reliable than the existing magneto-ignition systems. In 1909, Kettering left NCR to focus full-time on perfecting the final prototype. When Cadillac ordered 5,000 sets, the Barn Gang was incorporated as the Dayton Engineering Laboratories Company, or Delco for short. It was about this time that Henry Leland called on Kettering for help with his starting project. Boss Kett and his team rose to the challenge, working tirelessly until they had a working product in early 1911. Interestingly, it shared many details with the electric motor drive that Kettering designed for his cash register. Cadillac ordered 12,000 units, and the 1912 Cadillac became the first automobile with a self-starting engine. In 1916, Delco was acquired by United Motors Company. United Motors was founded by William C. Durant, who also had founded General Motors several years earlier. United Motors was a conglomerate of automotive parts companies that supplied parts to most of the automobile industry. One of the larger subsidiaries was the Hyatt Roller Bearing Company, which had been managed by Alfred P. Sloan. Like Kettering, Sloan had a degree in electrical engineering. However, his real skill was not inventing things, but in applying his precise analytical engineering skills to the management of a business. When Hyatt Roller Bearing was acquired by United Motors, Durant recognized Sloan's special abilities and made him president of United. In 1918, United Motors was merged into General Motors as a wholly owned subsidiary supplying parts exclusively to GM. Within a few years, Sloan was president of General Motors and Kettering was vice president and head of research and development. Kettering's engineering skills kept General Motors at the forefront of automotive technology for decades. And under Sloan's leadership, GM became the largest corporation on Earth. This also made both men very wealthy, and in their later years, they both became dedicated to philanthropy. One of their most significant philanthropic achievements was their contribution to the war on cancer. They both believed that the thoughtful application of modern industrial research and development techniques could greatly improve our understanding of cancer and its treatment. In 1945, Sloan postulated that if the medical field had access to as much money and talented personnel as the government had in developing the atomic bomb, that very rapid progress could be made in cancer research. And thus, the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center was born. In addition to pure research, another mission was education. One of the first trainees at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center was a young doctor from Pittsburgh named Harry Beisel. This doctor would eventually become a leader in the field of cancer treatment. He was hired by the prestigious Mayo Clinic to establish a cancer program there. He also co-founded the world's largest professional organization devoted entirely to cancer treatment, and he was instrumental in getting clinical oncology recognized as a board-certified medical specialty. He was truly a rock star in the world of cancer. He was also my father. So in this month of June, when we take time to honor our fathers on the Father's Day holiday, please allow me a moment to honor mine and to reflect on the notion that much of what I am today is because of the Titans of General Motors and a chain of events that started with a broken jaw in 1908.
So joining us now, technical issues getting here, just like we had technical issues getting started, and it all lined up correctly. So welcome back, Harold.
Thank you.
Last weekend, we went a little north to Butler, Pennsylvania, and to the Bantam Heritage Jeep Festival. Did I get that right?
I think it's Bantam Jeep Heritage Festival, but same thing.
And so that is the location where Jeeps first started, because Bantam started the Jeep.
Bantam Motors was based in Butler, PA, yes. And they did the original prototype of the Jeep.
They built, I think, a couple thousand or 10,000 or something, but couldn't keep up with orders, right?
Basically, yeah. They did not have the production capacity, and the military was worried they weren't going to fulfill the contract, so they gave the contract to Willys and Ford, even though it was a Bantam design.
And I had heard the story, I think it's true, but they had put the... They would take the Jeeps, they'd take them down to Pittsburgh, put them onto barges, and then float them on barges down the Allegheny. So it used to be the Allegheny, onto the Ohio, onto the Mississippi, down to New Orleans. And then New Orleans, they put them onto the LSTs, landing ship transports, and ship them over.
That sounds good. I wasn't around then to see it, so I don't know.
Neither was I. But we went to Butler, and they have a kind of a closed festival section, and then they had this open car show, lack of a better word, and we walked the streets, the street of Butler, the main drag in Butler. Saw a bunch of Jeeps that were new, old. All of them were the CJs, right? Which is the one everybody is familiar with. No Wagoneers, no Grand Wagoneers.
Well, we saw a few of the, we saw a Jeepster. I think another one on the road somewhere between our getting there. There were, I think there might have been an old Willie station wagon that we saw, but most of them were the CJ or the more modern other letter derivatives of the CJ, which I can't keep up with their letter designations. I'm sorry, but I just can't.
No, there are other podcasts for that.
So yeah, that's right. There's people that know that stuff, so I don't have to.
Please consult other podcasts. I think the 4x4 podcast talks a lot about that. They know their Jeeps.
And if I offend you because I don't know the difference between a TJ and a YJ and an XJ, I'm sorry, but too bad.
Yeah, well, that's no different than people not knowing the difference between a Range Rover and a Land Rover.
Well, yeah.
So we did see there were some military ones there. There's some nicely well done military Jeeps. They had almost like the EMLRA folks do. They had replica weapons attached to the vehicle. They had all the old lettering on the vehicle. There were a couple had 50 caliber machine guns in the bed.
Always fun to see a 50 cal mount.
Yeah. One looked like a 30 cal. It looked smaller than the 50 cal to me. Not that I know much about military weapons, but it was neat. It was a nice event. It was nice to see. Nice little visit.
And the military exhibit had guys in uniform, period uniform. That was always kind of nice.
And then as we're leaving, we're walking away, these guys were pushing a Jeep, and because it wasn't starting, which is like, hey, that sounds familiar.
Well, I think the chatter I was overhearing was the guy had his lights on for display and he ran his battery down.
That makes some sense.
Yeah,
makes
sure.
Some sense.
It happens.
It was that time of day. Yeah. But there, I will say one negative thing, and this has nothing to do with Jeeps. This is just more of an off-road thing. Is these LED light bars that people are putting on their vehicles now? I just way too much light. And then they love to have them on, and it's like way too bright. I see that being a problem. It has nothing to do with Jeeps. I've seen other vehicles do it.
Well, I think I hate to say it, but I think that the Jeep crowd is kind of the biggest offender in the over pimping arena. I mean, not to say that people don't do it to Rovers or any other kind of off roader, but it just seems like there's a higher pimp factor per capita, if you will, in the Jeep world, and there was plenty of that at the Jeep invasion.
Especially here in North America, this is the. There's a lot of that going on here.
You wait though, because I saw something real interesting out of the UK that came in my mail just recently. It's on the LRO list. I don't know if you get that or not, but
oh, I read that one this morning.
Yeah, isn't that obnoxious?
It is.
Well, do tell.
I don't think that there is anything made for a Land Rover that was not bolted to this particular Series 3.
Or anything made not for a Land Rover.
That could be made to fit one.
Yeah.
And it all had to be chromed. And the interior was completely done in oak.
Did James May have anything to do with this?
No, this is way beyond him. It's like somebody spent some time in the Philippines and decided to do that to his Land Rover.
So we went to Butler, PA. It was a Jeep festival. They have a private showing where they can camp out, and there's some trail rides for them to do, and they have some other excursions that they can go on that are paid. Again, we just attended the car show portion. So if you're and they've been doing this now for 3 or 4 years. This may be the fifth year that takes place up there. This is also a part show that takes place at the fairgrounds. So if you're ever in the Pittsburgh area and you want to see a bunch of Jeeps, especially those CJs.
Especially if Jeeps are your thing, it's a good festival for that crowd.
It was.
I mean, I like it for, the heritage part of it, obviously. And if I had to say one negative thing about this show was I don't think there was enough given to that. Seems to me if they're going to organize an event and they call it the Jeep Heritage Festival, that they would have a little more. They could set up some sort of static display or even a couple interpretive panels explaining the Bantam story better.
That's a good idea. And there were, I think, also not enough of the other models that you expect.
Well, and that's up to the people to bring, because unfortunately it's not, they don't curate the display. They don't, they don't bring in X number of certain models. I think maybe it's just because people didn't have anything like that to bring.
And for as far as Land Rover content is concerned, we did, Harold and I jumped into the 109, took the Series 3, drove up there. We best place to park was a block away. I did notice two waves from other Jeep folks, which was nice, and I waved back. There may have been more, but there were certainly a lot of Jeeps and got a lot of looks. But you know, we were also weren't going to crowd their space, and just kind of showed up, walked around, took some pictures, and jumped back in.
Now, when we stopped for dinner, apparently there was a crowd gathering around your truck then.
Yes. Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah, well.
So it still draws attention where it goes, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, the 109 has been on the road now for, I think it's been over a month now. We've been taken out fairly regularly, especially on the weekends. It's good driving it around. And, I have actually a nice little interesting story I can add. So last weekend I was driving around and I had to go out to the airport, drop off a cousin. I was driving around to different parties. And everywhere I go, I would get usually occasional email or I'd get a Facebook post and somebody would say, "Did I see your truck? Is that out and about?" I'm like, well, of course it is. How many Series 3 camo-colored ex-military vehicles are there in North America, let alone in Pittsburgh itself? And
teach them a registration number. They'll know for sure.
No, that's right. Exactly. Yeah, look for the registration number. And so then I was coming home. I was in part of Pittsburgh on one hill, and I'm driving home, and I'm about to make a left-hand turn to get down to the road back to my house, and all of a sudden, coming up the hill is a Defender, and I'm like, oh, look, it's a Defender, you know. And then it takes me a moment to realize it's Defender, and I don't think I recognize this, a hard-sided Defender, 110. And so I beep, you know, and they wave, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. And then the road clears, and I'm like, yeah, I got to turn right instead of turning left. So I turn right, I follow them. And they acknowledged that I'm following them, and finally pulled over, and we talked. And I found out that they pulled over, and the wife or the girlfriend says to the driver Ben, says, "You know, he's following us." And he goes, "Yeah, I know. We're almost home." So got home, pulled over. We chatted for a while. It was dark, but we chatted for a while. He had been in the military in the UK at Lincoln Heath and imported the Defender. And the 110, 1987, and imported it hard-sided and got stock. And turns out he had a 24-volt alternator I went home with.
He just happened to be looking for one for a spare.
Yeah, always on the lookout for parts. And, he threw it in the back of the truck, and I says, you know, I don't have any money on him. He goes, yeah, that's fine. So I sent him a check, and it's all taken care of. So now he's in the fold. He knows people, and he's getting plugged into our local Land Rover club. But there you go. I had to then post on Facebook. I was wrong. There, in fact, are other trucks that sort of kind of look like mine that someone might misinterpret. So there's another in Pittsburgh.
Especially if you don't know the difference between a 110 and a 109.
Right, right. And his is all painted all of green.
Yeah, okay. That's a common color.
Yeah, nice. His was a 110, 24-volt FFR. He's got a couple of the antennas on it, and it was nice. He's got that. What's the part in that they hook all the radios to on the inside? What do they call that?
I would just call it a rack. I'm not sure what they call it.
Yeah, so he actually has a rack on his, which is nice on the inside. But, that's pretty slick.
Yeah, we can get those equipment racks, or we can fabricate a facsimile.
Right. Well, it's just interesting that he had one. I don't know if I necessarily want one.
And now you know what those funny standoffs are sticking up.
Oh yeah,
out of your tub your head.
I've known what those were for, but I just hadn't had anything hooked up to it except for a car extinguisher.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you would do with such a thing.
Yeah, I don't know. It's getting away. I have access to.
I mean, once you set up your mobile video editing lab or something, then
that's a good idea.
Then maybe.
Yes.
Your truck is gradually becoming a rolling tech platform.
It is. So that was, there is another military Land Rover in the Pittsburgh area. Look out for Ben and Liz. Say hi as you're driving by. All right, we'll move on now to trail rides and overlanding. There is a difference between overlanding and trail riding. It's kind of subtle, at least I think to some folks they may not know the difference. In my mind, overlanding is the journey, getting somewhere. Usually you're on an actual road. You're going to go camping. You're going to go to a location, and you want to get there, and that's kind of the overlanding piece. Whereas trail riding is you gotten to that location and now you want to test your truck and you want to go over stones and rocks and go through a stream and all that business, and actually kind of you're there for a purpose to test the vehicle on a trail.
I tend to think of trail riding as a closed course event. You're just circulating around within a certain geographic region, whereas the overlanding, you have a specific destination in mind, and your goal is to travel to that destination.
Enjoy the journey.
Well, hopefully.
So we have several trail rides and overlandings to talk about. And the big one, which is the Arctic Circle trip, Steve, you got to wait for it. It's at the end of the. We're going to make you wait till the end of the podcast. So, but first up, going on right now as we speak at the Wilds in Ohio, there is a Land Rover specific event, and that's why Dave couldn't be with us today. He's actually at the event. I couldn't make it for work reasons, so he's there. We'll hopefully get a report from him next month on how the Wilds went. That takes place at a animal.
I think they call it a wild animal preserve.
Thank you. Yes, a wild animal preserve. Not in the preserve itself.
Well, they do often have an event where you can drive through the park, but generally it takes place across the highway on some spare land that the preserve owns.
Yeah, it's the fourth year that I've tried to go and couldn't make it. Apparently, I'm not...
This time, not due to mechanical mishap.
No.
I thought you made it last year.
No, I couldn't go. Something happened.
Oh, it was the Conclave you went to last year.
Went to Conclave.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yeah. There's an overlanding event taking place in July 11th and 13th. It's the Mid-Atlantic Overland Festival. Apparently, it is sponsored by Mainline Overland, which sounds like Maine, but it's not. I keep thinking Maine in my head.
It's the other Maine.
It's the other Maine, yes. And not the state. Apparently, it's not Land Rover specific. There are a bunch of other vehicles contributing, but this is an event taking place. And it's, you know, it's just kind of a, as they call it, a celebration and gathering of adventurers who want to share the stories, experiences, and be with like-minded individuals. So that event is taking place in a 200-acre working farm located in the Mountain Ridge and Valley section of Pennsylvania, just south of State College in the heart of the Mid-Atlantic region.
Well, that's not very far away.
That is not very far away at all, actually. We can be there in 2 hours. 11-13.
That's Vintage Grand Prix weekend, isn't it?
No, it's a weekend. It's the weekend before Vintage Grand Prix, which is, yes. So, yeah, coming on, that's another event to talk about, the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix. Go to pvgp.org.
I believe it's .org.
It's an org. That's a Vintage Grand Prix. They have a International Car Day, of which, you know, the British Car Day is part of that. And we typically attend that event. I've sent my registration in this year and trying to get a bunch of rovers to show up. And it's basically you get to park on a golf course and show off your car for a couple hours. And it's also a competitive show in a way. Those who bring a vehicle get to vote on the other vehicles, and you might win a plaque, which is nice, depending on your vehicle. Of course, we find with the Land Rovers, the more dirty it is, the muddier it is, the better it looks.
It would seem that way. Almost seem like the less maintained it is, the better it scores.
Except for the, what's his name from Latrobe that brings out the Series 2?
Frank from Ligonier.
Yeah.
Well, he sold that truck, so it's...
It is finally sold.
It is sold. It's actually sold quite a while, last year sometime.
Okay. Did it stay in the area?
It's out in the Pittsburgh area, and one of our associates now services it.
Nice.
And
nice.
There's possibility I may be getting involved with it at some point, but I have too much to do and not enough space, so I'm trying to put that off.
Right. So that's the Vintage Grand Prix British Car Day. It takes place. The car day itself takes place on Saturday, so I think that's July 12th. And if you're out and about, say hi, because I know I'll be there. So come to Pittsburgh. Nice event. And in addition to, you know, the car day, there's also the racing that takes place on city streets.
It is the only vintage racing event that still takes place on city streets.
They close.
And you know, yeah, of course they do. And through Schenley Park, the streets are an excellent venue for a race course because there's lots of corners and ups and downs. And it's generally well-liked, and the vintage community knows the race very well and is well-regarded.
And then in the end of July, 25th through the 27th is the Vermont Overland Rover event. It's a weekend event of it's much more relaxed. Some trail rides, basically open trail rides. They're going to be refurbishing a 67 Series 2A. They're also going to they're going to have a live auction of a let's see, what year is this? A 66 Series 2A that ECR, East Coast Rovers, converted a number of years ago to a coil sprung chassis. That's going to be pretty interesting. And our friend Jeffrey Aronson is going to be there as a special guest. So it should be pretty fun. I'll actually be, as long as there are no work emergencies, I should be there in attendance. I'm looking forward to that.
Cool. So you can meet up with Jeff, and then you guys can prepare a report for us.
Exactly.
Excellent.
And then in somewhat old news, also Series Land Rover related, the Land Rover Series Club of Puerto Rico had their first circle tour of the island earlier this year. I believe it was back in May, but I can't remember exactly. So they took basically a group of Series Land Rovers and took tours of some of the older, slower routes entirely around the island of Puerto Rico.
Took place in March.
Excellent.
Now, is this an on-road event?
On-road event.
Okay.
So it was a three-day tour, basically, around the island.
How many miles do you think that might be?
That's a very good question. That I don't know.
I mean, I don't think the island's all that big, but I think going around it, especially on secondary roads, kind of zigging and zagging, it might add up.
Exactly.
We'll have the article posted as part of the show notes, but if you go to expeditionportal.com, they have some nice pictures, and I'm just kind of scanning here to see if it tells you how long, but I don't see how much they actually journeyed as far as mileage is concerned. A lot of older series vehicles. I think it looks like I see a Defender or two, but some nice, really nice looking series trucks.
Yes, some very nice ones, some ones that are very well weathered and patinaed, and I think there were a couple of Defenders that attended.
So along the lines, in July, as a reminder, I think we talked about this last month, but the Muddy Chef Challenge 3 is taking place July 31, August 1, 2, 3 at Lime Rock Park in Lakeville, Connecticut. Not too far from you, is it, Morgan?
It's probably about 6 hours.
Oh, okay.
Maybe a little longer. So.
Oh, with those Vermont roads, even across the state can be quite a trip.
Oh, yeah. Where I keep my rover that I'm restoring is about 2.5 hours from where I am.
So the Muddy Chef Challenge is cooking, shooting, off-roading, fun, adventure. Looks like not a Land Rover-specific event, but lots of rovers show up for that. Looks like a lot of discos, series trucks.
I think it actually used to be called the Land Rover Muddy Chef Challenge. So if it is not rover-specific, that's new.
Yeah, I think it's very... I think they let any vehicles in, but it's primarily Land Rover. I believe that Rovers North is a sponsor.
Actually, Atlantic
British. Incorrect on that.
Atlantic British is.
Atlantic British, okay, that's right.
Yeah, there's Orvis.
Yeah,
the one that stands out to me.
We need to find somebody who's going and get a report.
Definitely.
It sounds like an interesting event.
We have Steve drive over and.
Yeah. How tall's the snorkel on your truck, Steve?
Not quite, but if anyone wants to lend me a 110, I'll gladly take it.
Of course. Also, there's this is a actual from Land Rover news from Land Rover about off-roading and adventuring. There's a well-known yachting journalist, photographer, and passionate Land Rover enthusiast, Jay Coyle, and his wife, Neela. They're setting off from Florida on a 20,000-mile drive around America in their 2013 Land Rover Disco 4, LR4 for those of you in America, called Blue. It will be their fourth long-distance Land Rover driving adventure since 2010. And sounds like they're just going to go out and about, drive up from Florida to Alaska and back down again and take some pictures. I think he's aiming to ultimately have a book with, obviously, pictures from all his journeys here. I think that's the plan.
Sounds like a good coffee table book.
Yeah, exactly. And if he's a photographer. Hopefully, this would be some good shots. There's a couple good ones here. Well, they have a summer home in Quebec. I like Quebec. Anyway, that's off topic. So that's happening. So if you see a blue, it's actually a blue.
Gee, imagine that.
D4 running around. You get a nice picture. Maybe you'll be in a book. It's like the third person I've heard headed to Alaska this year. Shall we move to the UK and some UK events with our new UK correspondent, Steve?
Hey. Yeah, there's actually three that I want to talk about. One is the Billing Land Rover Fest in July 25th to the 27th. It's up the road from me, so I will be going to it. It's a big event with Auto Jumble, all the Land Rover clubs, or a lot of Land Rover clubs go to it. Cars for sale, demonstrations, all the off-roading kind of thing, different challenges and whatnot. That's a really great show to go to. Probably the best or the major show for the UK is the Land Rover Owners International Show. And this takes place on the 20th and 21st of September in Peterborough in a showground. And they have everything there. All the G4 Defenders and all the G4 and Camel Trophy trucks are there. Loads of shows, loads of challenges, loads of trials. They've even got a off-road course that's set out for people to go and make use of. They're actually making use of a speedway track. I'm not quite sure what they're going to do with a speedway track with the Land Rovers, but they're going to make use of that.
We can bring out the Land Rover Sport Supercharge.
Yeah, the super fast one. And
the one.
Yeah. Extreme live action, apparently, in the LRO live action arena. And it's all the trade stands, and it's a huge show. And I went to it last year. Again, it's another one I will be going to this year. So that's a really big show, and that's on the 20th and 21st of September.
Did you get any ideas or help or tips for your overland journey from the show?
Not from that one. From the next one I'm going to talk about, which is the Adventure Overland Show that takes place in Stratford. I went to that last year, and I did get ideas. Now, this is the Adventure Travel and Overland Show, 27th to 28th of September. It's not Land Rover based, but it's all about the adventure travel. So it's for the motorbikes, for cyclists, motorhomes, you name it. Even the huge military converted trucks, they're all there, the man trucks and Bedford and DAF and all this different kind of thing. But it also has bush mechanics. So they're going to have some demonstrations on how to do emergency repairs when you're out in the middle of nowhere. They do bushcraft, survival, different shows and displays, and it's a really big overlanding show. And this one was really quite good, and it gave me a few inspirations of what to do. And really, it kind of shows that things are quite simple. There's, you know, you can go in anything and go anywhere. I mean, Defender 110s are, you know, they're in the multitude here. Loads of people take them and just park them up in the car parks. They're so common, they're not actually allowed to use them as display vehicles anymore because there are so many. Nothing special about them anymore. But there are some huge military vehicles that people have converted. And they're like homes, but six-wheel drive, eight-wheel drive kind of unit. That's a really good show. Loads of people there, loads of experienced people that have done a lot of the overlanding around the world. You know, it's the authors, the occasional TV celebrity presenter, what you might want to call them. And like I say, talks, displays, talks about navigation, talks about motorcycle, there's the converters. It's a really big show. And that's one that I'm especially looking forward to.
Does it take place like on an old airfield, or is it?
It's actually at Stratford upon Avon Racecourse. So it's actually a horse race course.
Oh, I see.
And so they've just got a big open land, and then they've got an exhibition hall as well that they make use of. But it is really good. I will be going for a couple of days. I'll be camping there just to try and get as much knowledge as I can, really.
Is there an entry fee?
There is. Unfortunately for all of them, there are. To stay there for the weekend, it's £45.
That's
but not I bad. Think it's not really.
Do you get services for that? Do they have, like, you know, toilets and showers?
Yes. Yeah, they've got that there. And you get a plot of land to put your vehicle on. Nice. I think the price might only be about £15 anyway per day to get in.
We will have links to this in the show notes, so if you want to check it out and see more about it, we'll have it's adventureoverlandshow.com, but I'll put the link out.
Yeah, it's very good.
Did I delay enough for you to find the price?
Yes, it's £12 per person per day at the gate, or £10.80 if you purchase them online beforehand.
Sweet.
Yeah,
cool.
Very good.
Are you looking to get some tips for your motorbike, for future motorbike trips?
Not just at the moment. I thoroughly enjoyed the 110 around Norway and the Arctic. And to be honest, I couldn't imagine myself doing it on a motorbike. But it's not impossible, but I think that's a little bit away. But this is more going to be about my next trip that I'm trying to decide where I'm going to go. But I think I'm definitely going to need a little bit of more outdoor and survival kind of training to make it if I go where I want to go.
Interesting. Any previews?
Not just at the moment, because I'm still thinking about a couple of different areas.
All right.
It might be very south and it might be very hot.
Okay. That's good.
I have an idea. I think I have an idea.
I remember, though, in our previous conversation, you were saying that you had originally dreamed of doing this Norway trip by a motorbike.
That's absolutely right, had
to change plans for the 110, but now it sounds like the 110 has totally spoiled it for the motorbike.
You know, I think it will, because I don't believe I'd have enjoyed it anywhere as much as on a bike, because it would have been quite hard work, and the being able to stop very kind of quickly and just have a quick look around and then get going again. And I just think the convenience of being able to stop wherever I wanted to, not worry about pitching a tent or anything along those lines, and just sleeping in the back of the car made a big difference. There was one night in particular. I know we're kind of going a bit ahead here.
Why don't we get to the third show you want to talk about, and then we'll jump over.
Well, I was going to say, I've done them: the Billing one, the Land Rover International, and the Adventure Travel show. So that's all three done.
I didn't count correctly. Well, we will have links to all of those on the show notes. But so why don't we formally get to the follow up that we started 2 months ago with you?
Since we've already started anyway, let's just formally start it.
And yeah. Steve does have a blog, and I will have a link again to that on our website, which is steveinreallife.wordpress.com. I followed it, Steve, as you were traveling, going back and forth. We tried to get you to join us on the last podcast. I know we had, I can only imagine if we had bandwidth problems, I guess. You were concerned about your bandwidth and being on the road. Glad we didn't have the technical problems while you were doing that. But So you spent 16, 17 days out on the road. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start from the end? You want to start from the beginning? Do you want to tell us how it went? I guess we'll also pepper you with questions.
Yeah, okay. Right. So, first thing is, it's easy. It's so easy to do. And people wouldn't believe it, and I've come home and I've talked to people about it, and it's so easy to do. The traveling through France, Belgium, and Netherlands, fairly straightforward. But when you get into Germany and Denmark and Sweden, just the infrastructure it's just made for covering the long distances. Big roads, very clear, lots of places to park and stop. And these aren't anything special. They're just big car parks on the side of the, highways and things like that, really. But it's all really set up. And I guess it's for the truck drivers and so on to kind of cover the large distances. So getting through was a piece of cake. And then when you actually get into Norway, it's not such large roads and not like such large kind of areas, but there are loads of rest stops, loads of toilets around, loads of a lot more towns than you expect there to be, or than I expected there to be anyway. And yeah, just the whole journey up into the Arctic Circle was actually really quite simple and straightforward. Yeah, it was great. It was quite warm, quite hot most of the 3 weeks that I was out there, which again was another surprise.
Yeah, not what you expect to hear on a report from Norway.
No, and that's the thing. Actually, when I was in the Arctic Circle, I got there for my birthday as planned. It was actually so warm that I had my 12-volt portable shower stuck to the side of the 110, and I was showering outside. No issues at all. It was that hot. Yeah, it was a real surprise.
How hot was it, though?
I couldn't tell you because I didn't have a thermometer. It was probably Celsius, maybe 16, 17, 18, something like that. For me, that's more than hot enough. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit.
That's mid to upper 60s Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Because 20 is 68.
Well, you'd basically double it at 32.
Hmm.
Times 1.8 plus 32 if you really want to get technical, but yes.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, when you're driving through, driving on a road, and either side of you, there are, the snow is above the height of the 110. That's how deep the snow had been. So it was easily 8 to 10 feet, deep, some of the snow, but they keep it clear, and they keep it really clear. In some ways, it was a little bit disappointing because I was hoping to have a bit of a challenge around there. But in other ways, it just made it very easy to travel around. Even in the mountains, I think the highest point I got up to was about 4,500 feet. Even then, it was still quite warm, a bit of a chill wind, but it was warm. But I managed to stay on a patch of gravel up around there as well, and stayed there for the night.
Did you always sleep in the vehicle?
Apart from one night, which was the one night when I had my minor breakdown. Not me personally, but the wheel bearings went on the, well, basically they seized, and I couldn't even get the hub off to try and change them. So unfortunately, that was one night that I had to be towed to a garage, and I stayed in a hotel.
Yeah, but that was at the end of your journey on the way home.
Right? It was actually on the way home. Yeah, I only had about 300 miles left, but the rest of the time it was all in a 110. So, like I say, the infrastructure is amazing. They have a load of tourist routes set up that you can go and just basically drive along. With lots of different architectural attractions. So I started covering all of those. In fact, it was so easy that I was making up time every single day. I was planning to drive for 150 miles because I was expecting that to take me a good 4 or 5 hours. But it took 3 hours. So I had hours every day that I was starting to make up. So I was starting to travel further, and I actually started to see more of the southern area of Norway than I actually planned to. That's the thing. It was so easy to do.
So how did the picture in the fjord with the cruise ship in it come about? That's like day 12, I think.
Yeah, that was a place called Geiranger. When you actually start traveling along the fjords, they go for miles. You're traveling along them for miles, and then you'll take a winding road up mountains, and then you just come down the other side of the mountains on the winding roads. So it's literally as the standard routes. There's normally only one or two roads that pass through towns. And that particular field is apparently the most beautiful, the most spectacular field. I would agree with that. So they actually take cruise ships in there, and that's the size of the fields. that they actually travel through there with the cruise ship. And actually visit a few of them.
Any idea how far up you were? Because that in that picture, that cruise ship's far off. And
I have other photos that I haven't yet uploaded, but I actually got to a point where the cruise ship was. I was on the shore just beside it. I was probably at about 500-ish feet there. I started seeing it from about a mile or 2 miles away. Eventually I actually made it down to the town and I was literally on the shore where it was berthed.
Were there a lot of other folks doing what you were doing, traveling? Were you the only one, not just in that fjord, but even on your own journey?
Well, when you get up the further north that I got, there was less and less traffic. It felt like I was pretty much the only person around. When you actually get into the Arctic Circle, I went maybe 100 or so miles a little bit further north. It felt like I was the only person who was there without purpose. Everyone else, it was work and it was people doing their, living their lives. There weren't many people traveling. As I came back down to the south and where that fjord was, there were convoys of motorhomes and camper vans. There's a lot of people that travel around there, around that particular area. In the north, it was empty. In the south, it was really quite busy, to the extent where you do worry when you're actually on some of the mountain roads, how they would pass each other. That's the thing. I didn't have that much of an issue, but I wouldn't want to be in a motorhome traveling around some of those roads.
Do you think some of that is seasonal because it was so early in the season?
I do. I think that motorhomes will increase. The number of motorhomes over there will increase as the summer progresses. I think I was early in the season, and that was potentially what made it less. I don't think people travel up to the north as much. I happened to bump into a small group of guys from the Norsk Land Rover Owners Club, and I actually took a day off-roading with them. And there was an English guy that had been living in Norway for 37 years, and he hadn't been as far north as I had. So it's one of those things where even the people in the country don't go up into the northern part. So much. So it's not a popular area up there, but it's a great place to go.
Did you encounter any problems or difficulties once you got to the Arctic Circle? Were you worried about anything? Was it super cold that you were worried about freezing to death?
Bizarrely, unfortunately, not. Like I was saying, I was hoping there would be some challenge to it, but there really wasn't. And it's a little bit of a shame. But like I say, on the other hand, it was easy. It was a breeze.
Are the roads paved up there?
Yeah, absolutely. They've got better roads than they have in the UK. I think I saw in Norway, I might have seen maybe two or three police, but I saw every day maybe three or four road surveyors where there's people just in cars traveling the roads, making sure that they're clear and making sure they're not blocked. It's like their highway maintenance group. They're all over the place, even to an extent where on one night I stayed on a path where there had been a really small, I wouldn't call it an avalanche, but a really small amount of snow had covered the road. And in the morning, I just watched them clearing it. So it's really, really well maintained. It's amazing. It makes it a little bit unexciting, but at the same time, it is just so easy to do.
Kind of an anti-climax, if you will.
A teeny bit. I mean, don't get me wrong, the place is amazing. The place is beautiful, and you can't get over seeing the amount of raging rivers and waterfalls, and you're driving through mountain ranges that are still covered with snow, but the roads are completely clear. So it's still amazing and an awesome place to go. It's just very easy.
Speaking of roads, how awesome is the Atlantic Road with the flying bridges?
Now, it is great, and I thought it would be a great idea to try and film myself crossing that bridge. Now, I had to stop, find somewhere to put a video camera. Then I walked back to the car, went up over the bridge, came back again, came back to the video camera, realized that I hadn't switched it on. So then set it up again and walked off and did the whole thing. And in my mind, it would have been a really great shot. Unfortunately, actually, when I looked at the video camera or looked at the video footage probably a few hours later, I was a speck in the distance. I was a dot on the horizon, in effect. But it didn't work as well as I hoped it was going to. It's that whole region.
I hope you still post that video.
When I get to it, all my photos are going to be going up on something, maybe a Flickr or some kind of thing. I'll probably make a bit of use of YouTube because I've got literally tens or maybe a few hours of footage just driving around Norway, past the fields, through the mountain areas, and all that kind of thing.
Where'd you put the camera on? From the inside of the vehicle, outside?
Yeah, it was inside the front windscreen.
Did you have a GoPro or something similar?
Yeah, GoPro 2. So I had that set up. Great. I was taking some still shots with it. But like I say, I've been back a couple of weeks and I just haven't had the opportunity yet to get them all uploaded.
Oh, I hear that.
Mm.
So then you had a nice little adventure while you were there. I know you encountered an off-road group. How did that transpire?
Well, it was literally a case of, it was a Sunday morning, and I was just traveling along one road, and at a fuel station was a Defender, a Discovery, a Freelander, and a Jeep.
You had to pull over.
Well, that was the thing, of course, because you'd see them, and I kind of cruised past and waved and all that kind of thing. I thought, you know, on a Sunday morning, it's only one thing that those guys are doing. So I turned around, they'd set off, and so they came past me then in the other direction. So I turned around and followed them, basically just followed them to a sand kind of pit, sand gravel pit, that they've been given free rein to use by the owner. And so they just then spend the day off-road across all this gravel pit. And it was actually the Norsk Land Rover Owners Club. It was one faction of it, one particular region area of it. Just met up with those guys and then just spent the day off-roading in their vehicles because last thing I wanted to do was do any damage to my old girl.
You were right at home.
Yeah, exactly. I had a long way to go. Just spent the time with those guys and it made for a really good day. And that was the fortunate thing, that with the amount of hours that I could make up with the traveling, it gave me days free, so I just used up one day with them.
You just happened to luck into that, and I bet that they were as pleased as you were, if not more, to have you there with them.
Yeah, and I think so. I mean, I know that the photos were taken, and apparently it was going to be going in their next magazine, so that's great. It was actually quite funny, because when I was there, I started chatting to one guy, Otto was his name, and he was starting to tell me about another Englishman that they knew. And as he was literally talking about it, this guy turned up, and he was in a 110 Defender, silver, with English flags in the rear windows. And he turned up, he goes, and Otto was saying, here you go, here's the Englishman now, he'll come and talk to you, and he'll spend the day with you. I was like, yeah, great. David started chatting to me, and he's like, oh yeah, I haven't spoken to anyone, you know, in English for quite a long time. I was like, okay, when? And he goes, well, a couple of years ago I was over in England and so on. And I said, so how long have you been in Norway then? It's like 37 years. I'm like, and they still call you the Englishman? Oh yeah, I'll always be the Englishman. And he loves it, and he would never leave. He says he'd never bother coming back to the UK again. He met a Norwegian lady and moved
there you
down
go.
There. Yep. And he's not with that Norwegian lady anymore, but he's with another Norwegian lady. And so he's staying out there. But yeah,
come for the scenery and stay for the women.
Yeah, well, there you go. But yeah, it was really good. Very good day. They made me really welcome. And yeah, helped them out, actually, because one of the guys broke down. And I just happened to have every tool that you could possibly need in the car. So it was good to actually be able to, you know, help them out and get one of the guys up and running again. It was a Freelander that broke down. Just wanted to throw that in.
Careful.
Yeah, it was a really good day. Really good day. In total, I think about 10 different vehicles turned up. And so it made for a really good day.
But the Freelander acquitted itself quite nicely, I assume.
One would assume, yes.
Were you the star of the day then, the focus? Was everybody excited? There was
A foreigner. There was a little bit. I was definitely made to feel welcome and definitely the guest. They had a barbecue in the afternoon, and I was definitely made to feel like a guest of honor kind of thing. The first person to get the hot dog and so on and so forth. They did tell me that it was actually food tasting rather than actually anything.
Yeah, make sure it's good enough for them to eat.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it was good. There was a couple of guys in the discoveries in probably only a year or so old discoveries that were trying to get stuck. And they spent hours just trying to get kind of beached onto sand or whatever it is, just so that they could practice their recovery techniques and winching and using high lift jacks and so on and so forth.
Sounds like any discovery owner you've ever met, ever encountered, they all seem the same.
Yeah, although the ones that still have a factory warranty underneath them tend to be even more so.
Right, okay. But yeah, so it was actually quite an entertaining day. It was good. So that was how that came about.
Did you get a sense from them, are there a lot of Land Rovers in Norway or in that vicinity? Were they special, unique?
Well, I can answer that for myself, because I didn't see very many at all, not in Norway. That 10 that I saw then was probably the same as I would have seen for the rest of the time I was there. There's really not a lot of them around. When you move into Denmark and start heading kind of back to the UK, there's quite a lot. And the reason for that is that because there's no vehicle manufacturing in Norway, they import every single car that they have. And so they have a huge variety of cars. So they a lot of Dodge Rams out there, Corvette, Mustang, old classic American cars, but anything from one range to the other. I think I saw 3 Teslas out there. They just have every car you can think of, and therefore there's not that many specific.
Wasn't Top Gear in Norway a couple of years back, or maybe even longer, and they went to like an American auto show. There were a lot of old American cars, and it was kind of, in my mind, it was a strange place, I thought. It may have been Norway.
I thought that was Sweden, because I know there's a big following of the classic American cars in Sweden, and the bigger the better.
I mean, I don't know, but I could understand why, because it, like I say, it's so easy to travel, and it makes no difference to them what cars they purchase. They're all really expensive. They have to import all of them, and so they just choose whichever ones they want, really, rather than going for any cheaper models like you might do in the UK or wherever. They just buy whatever vehicle they actually want to buy.
So what was your most surprising thing that happened on the journey itself?
Probably having the shower on my birthday in the Arctic Circle in the open air. That was a surprise.
Were you in your birthday suit?
Yeah. I had some shorts. But that was probably the one thing.
Do you have that expression in the UK, your birthday suit? Do you know what that means?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So I figured there you are on your birthday, having a shower in your birthday suit.
Not quite, but close.
Only you, John.
I thought it was funny.
So it probably that Also, I went to the Pulpit Rock, the most inaccessible place that I went to. It was a 2-hour hike to get there. The rocks were put in place of steps to get up to it. It's probably about something like an 800 or 900 feet raise to actually get up to the rock. And it was about 2 hours to walk to it, trek to it, hike to it, whatever you want to call it. And there were queues. There were queues of people going there and queues of people coming back. The most inaccessible place and the hardest place to get to and also the busiest.
Just one person on the trail at a time?
It's single file pretty much. Single line going up and single line coming down.
Did you call this the pulpit?
Pulpit Rock, yes. Okay.
As in like a church pulpit?
Yes.
Okay.
If you Google it, it's also Preikstolen. It was, I think I've got a very quick photo of it on about day 14.
Yeah, I recall you talking about, you took a side journey and I remember talking about that. So that was that journey.
Now, is this part of some sort of religious pilgrimage and that's why it's so busy?
No, it's just a very tall rock.
And it overlooks a fjord?
Yeah, overlooks a fjord called Lizzie Ford. And again, it's a beautiful sight. It's amazing when you get up there again. It's just this big flat rock that people were sat on, but there were hundreds of people there. And so it's not quite the spiritual thing you might think of just because of the amount of people that were around. So that was another surprise.
Little interjection question, and it's
sure.
Supposed to be somewhat humorous too. At any point, did you not think of Douglas Adams throughout this entire journey? Because every time I hear fjord, I think of Douglas Adams and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
And Slarty Bartfast. I mean, I think we had a quick chat on Facebook. He was, I think, between you, me, and a friend of mine, John.
Yep.
We're talking about it. And, I can see why he would have enjoyed making the fiddly bit. It was really very good.
You can see why the Earth Cut was so expensive. Extra money on the fjords.
Yeah, when you get to that bit, definitely.
A lot of details there.
Yeah. And this is the thing, it was really easy, surprisingly easy to do. Like I say, a little bit too easy for me, but it made for a good journey anyway.
Any regrets or things that you would have done differently?
No, not at all. Maybe I'd have changed the wheel bearings before I went. but other than that, I wouldn't do it.
I think for the journey you took and what you did, I think the wheel bearings going at the end of the journey, that was minor.
Far better than having them go at the Arctic Circle, for instance.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, luckily I took two sets with me, and after it was a Land Rover main dealer that changed the bearings for me. And they said, your other ones need doing. You should do them when you get back to the UK. I was like, yeah, I'll get them done. And I set off, and it was, a day or two after that, I actually realized how bad the other set were. So I just stayed in a rest stop and, just changed them myself. But I think that would be the only thing I would do is just maybe a little bit more servicing. But then that was at 4,200 miles. And 4,200 miles of a lot of mountain road, would have put a big strain on the bearings anyway. I think the vehicle did really well for that.
Did you calculate your mileage or?
I recorded it. So I knew the mileage before I left. And when I got back, I knew what my mileage had been. So it was actually, just about, I think, 4,500 and a few miles in total.
Any problems getting fuel and?
None whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I had jerry cans spare, right. A couple of small jerry cans on top of the vehicle, but no problem whatsoever. And that's what I said. Food was fine because there are supermarkets on the roads. This is one of the things. It was like you were saying earlier on about overlanding. It's not necessarily the fact that it needs to be a challenge or anything like that. It was the journey doing it, and the journey was really easy. Everywhere that I went to was very nice. you look, just look at the photos on the blog and you'll get an idea of it. When I get to it, I'll put more up. But it was just really easy. And there were no issues at all with any, at no point did I feel vulnerable. Let's put it that way. So it was very good.
Well, I'm pleased that you managed to find a local club too, because I think we had that conversation before you went. That, you know, it's kind of a nice idea when you're going somewhere to know where the clubs are, and you, despite not doing that, still found them and by pure luck and had a good time.
After leaving Norway, I got into Denmark, and I'll be honest, sorry to anyone who might be listening from Denmark, it just got boring from there on.
It's kind of a letdown after Norway.
Norway, everything was literally flat. But the last few days were literally a quick journey through different countries. I stayed in Belgium for a couple of days, went to Amsterdam, which I hadn't planned to do, went to Bruges that I hadn't planned to do. So I just caught in a few other bits and pieces as I was on the way back.
Well, you know, Steve, here in the U.S., we do say the same things, because if you're traveling, if you're going especially west to east or east to west of the United States, the middle bits, flat, uninspired. Mm-hmm. Nebraska is not much different than Indiana, not much different than Ohio. And so I can understand that. I get the point about it being flat and straight, and it looks all one after the same. Because really, once mm-hmm. you get out of eastern Ohio, which is some rolling hills still, then it gets really flat, and it's flat till you get to Colorado.
Mm.
My mother lives on a farm in the middle of nowhere, Illinois.
Ugh. There's a little bit of scenery crossing the Mississippi and things like that. There's a whole lot of nothing otherwise.
Well, you know, now they have these wind farms, and you can see these giant windmills, especially out in Indiana and Illinois. They go on for 100 miles. You can see them all because it's that flat. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. You get into Nebraska, and you can see the tree from anywhere in the state.
Actually, you know what's in Nebraska? Carhenge.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I've been there. And if you see my pictures, keep going. You know, it's not worth your time. I'm sorry, Alliance, right. Nebraska.
Well, you're not enough of a car guy to really appreciate it. Sorry to say, but you're not.
I like cars, and I appreciate cars, and I like Stonehenge. I've been to Stonehenge. I will say the same thing I said about Stonehenge. Well, said about Carhenge. If you've seen the pictures, you don't need to go.
Pictures make it better than the real life.
Yeah,
huh?
Same thing with Mount Rushmore. Mount Rushmore is a letdown when you go to Mount Rushmore. Because you've seen the pictures, and if you see North by Northwest,
I saw Rushmore one time in an evening show. They played a movie on the making of it, and then as soon as the movie was done, they killed the screen and they hit the floodlights. And you're looking up Lincoln's nose, basically, and it's pretty spectacular that way.
But, well, you said the appropriate word. It's a show.
Yeah,
and when you do a show, then it comes out much better. But just to roll up and say, "Hey, here's some dead guys 100 feet tall on a mountain,"
right? Yeah, it's not as exciting when you just walk up and look. So, Steve, you going to go back to Norway someday?
I'm not one for retracing tracks. However, I want to get to the top of Norway, to the most northern part. But doing it, if I do it again, it'll be through Sweden and through Finland, and then I'll get to the very top. Which is the highest point in Europe. And then from there on, all you've got is just water and ice to the North Pole.
Further north from where you were would the top be?
I would need to travel probably another 500 or 600 miles north-ish.
Wow.
So not that far, but still a fair distance.
Still, that's bigger than I thought Norway was.
Yeah, Norway is surprisingly big.
It looks small on a map.
Yeah. Everywhere looks smaller on a map compared to the U.S.
Okay.
It's long. That's the issue with Norway. It's actually quite a long country.
I had one other question. I think I know the answer, but you enjoy traveling by yourself.
Yeah.
I thought so.
Yeah, very much.
I'm the same way.
Yeah. It's one of the things that gives you a chance to think and switch off from everything. And you don't have the hassle of worrying about whether anyone else is enjoying themselves or, and if you get lost, you can get lost and it's your own fault and you figure it out for yourself. And you know, all that kind of thing with it. And the other thing, these 3 weeks that I was off, that I was out there, if when I came back, if you'd have said I left 2 months ago, then I would have believed it. There was so much that I did, so far that I traveled, that it felt like I've been away for a really long time, and came back absolutely refreshed. And I think that's kind of down to the distance that I did, and also kind of being in your own world for that amount of time.
Steve, yep. Thanks for your report on telling us about your journey to the Arctic Circle. Thanks for joining us a couple months ago, too, and giving us the preview. Glad you had a great time. Nice follow on the blog. Appreciate your interaction with us and keeping us up to date. And so I want to thank you for coming back on to the show. I think I'll speak for the rest of the group. I think we can make you an official member of the panelist if you want to come back on anytime. Be happy to include you.
I'd like to hear you come back after the shows and give us a rundown on the shows over there.
Okay.
Definitely. If we don't have you sooner, definitely have you back after those. You go to the shows. Yeah.
Yeah, no problem.
Great. Well, that brings a close the 15th episode of the Center Steer podcast. If you have comments, questions, concerns, or maybe you even have a technical tip that you'd like to get answered by Harold, feel free to shout out to us via Twitter, on Facebook, even Google+, although not much happens on Google+. We've had some good interactions on Facebook. There's been some good comments there. So we'll do another shout out to Derek, who listens from St. Louis. And he has a nice, I didn't pull it up. It's a Series 2, isn't it?
I believe it's a 2A.
2A, I think so. Yeah, nice. It's a nice one. So shout out to you, Derek, and thanks for listening. And hopefully also a shout out to our new Pittsburgh listeners, Ben and Liz, in their Defender 110. So thanks, everybody, for listening. We will talk to you next month for the next edition of the Center Steer podcast.
Center Steer theme song, Sunset Rider, by the Tritons, is available for Nibio's Music Gallery. Check it out at music.nibio.com.
Well, I think I've got the wrong headset on completely.
Oh, see, it's not been our fault. It's been yours all along.
It just occurred to me that this isn't the headset I thought it was.
These are not the droids you're looking for.